Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Water is the lifeblood of all systems, yet we take it for granted, until the crops wither, the forests burn, and the fish die. A series of events have forced water to the forefront of public and scientific concern. Urban growth, industrial development, drought, and climate change are all contributing to severe and continuing water shortages across Alberta. Enter WISE, the Water Institute for Semi-Arid Ecosystems. This is an interdisciplinary research collaboration spearheaded by the University of Lethbridge. The university's Dennis Fitzpatrick, Derek Peddle, and Brent Selinger introduce some of the concerns the Water Institute will investigate. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. The summer of 2002 was marked by temperatures that soared into the 40s and weeks without rain. Huge forest fires burned across the north, and across the prairies, farmers pleaded for hay to feed their cattle or sold them in desperation. Shallow lakes dried up, and rural folks started trucking water from further and further away. With climate change and prolonged drought, it's a bleak scenario we can only expect to get worse, unless we learn to adapt and to use our precious water resources more wisely. Dennis Fitzpatrick couldn't have picked a more appropriate acronym for his latest endeavor, the Water Institute for Semi-Arid Ecosystems, WISE. As Associate Vice President of Research at the University of Lethbridge, Dennis has brought together an amazing consortium of scientists and industrial partners to help us deal with our water crisis.
We live in a semi-arid ecosystem. We live in a fragile ecosystem. We live in an ecosystem which is dependent upon water. It's funny because you talk to people and the land mass under agriculture is fairly small within the region. You've got about 5% of the land mass under agriculture, but because it's irrigated agriculture, you produce about 20% of the net farm income. We have intensive livestock operations here, and they depend upon pure, clean water. What's different about us is that we live in an area which has always been challenged as far as water is concerned, and now with the possibility of global warming, the effects that global warming is going to have on water, that there will even be more of a challenge.
What is the overall thrust in terms of your research? What are you going to try and get out of all of this?
Okay, we have identified what we call three core research themes. Now, the idea of developing core research themes is to get teams of researchers, individuals with different skill sets, to look at some of the major problems and in a different way than we've done before. I mean, traditionally, we've looked at research as very time-limited goals. You would do a research program for 2 or 3 years, you'd produce some answers, you'd write a report, and you'd go on. But a lot of the environmental research has to be patient research. It takes a number of years to do, and it's perhaps beyond the scale of a mere mortal single scientist to have the patience to make research work that way. For example, if you're going to look at microbiological organisms moving through the ecosystem, 1 year you've got rain, the next year you don't have rain, so you only have one sample. It takes time and it takes patience to do that. So we're putting together research teams to look in issues such as water safety and quality. So water safety and quality, so we bring in an environmental microbiologist and we marry the environmental microbiologist off to someone who does global positioning research. And the microbiologist does the microbes, looks at it, identifies it, watches what's in the ecosystem, and the GIS specialist tells them exactly where they are. And that's the kind of marriage that you need to go forward. We need to look at the aquatic ecosystems. And you have two views on water and waters on the rivers. The issue of what is the necessary in-stream flow to maintain that aquatic habitat is a core issue to the Institute. I mean, water is the lifeblood of agriculture. As you take water out of the system, you influence the aquatic ecosystem and the fish and animals that live around it. And I think it's very important to have the scientists that are involved in the productive agriculture and the scientists that are involved in the protection of the aquatic ecosystems sitting at the same table, looking at the same data, making informed decisions. And hopefully that's the kind of thing that this Water Institute is going to do. We've got a major emphasis on climate change in the primary and the prairie ecosystem. As climate change, it's going to alter snowpack. As snowpack is altered, the amount of water that's going to be available for irrigation, the amount of water that's going to be available for your own home is going to change. And we think it's important for us to get the tools in place so that we can estimate what the water flow is going to be so that we can manage this valuable resource as best as possible. Now, this is all science, but there are other issues that we really have to look at. What about the social science, the impacts of water, the impacts of water on a community? What about the economics of water? I mean, the issue, some of the fundamental questions as when water is scarce, how do you best use it? They haven't been addressed well. So what we're trying to do is to build teams of researchers. We're trying to build on what researchers are available within the universities. We're trying to build with to include federal researchers and provincial researchers. And we think this is a winning strategy in the long term.
With your comments about the social aspect of water, water is highly politicized at this time in the province, and there's talk of water diversion schemes and not enough water for the farmers down here. Bringing together all these scientists and researchers, how are you going to put that into the political context?
I think the best the scientists can do is just to stay out of the politics. I don't think science and politics necessarily blends all that well. But what we have to do is we have to produce sound information that can be interpreted and used by those making decisions and by the public. An informed public is a requisite. I mean, one of the issues in developing this institute was that we developed a significant communication plan so that the users, the public, can understand what is actually going on with the environment.
What are some of the interesting things that you're finding out right now?
Right now, we are at a point where we're moving from individual projects to larger scale projects, more long-term projects. Water research is very interesting because it is so surprising in many ways. I was at a meeting this morning in which a scientist from Agriculture Canada was presenting data looking at how you water animals and how they grow. And what they were comparing was animals given free access to water in a natural setting, basically walking down the riverbank, taking a drink out of a dugout and coming back, to water which is provided from a well in a remote distance from the riparian area. And what they saw was that by moving the animals off the riverbanks and by cleaning up the water, by providing them with a higher quality water, the animals actually grew better and were healthier. And what a win-win situation you have. You move the animals away from the fragile ecosystem, the riverbanks, you move them away from the water, and you're providing them with fresh water, and they're growing better. And so the environment wins, and the farmer wins. And I think that was just remarkable from its standpoint. We want to break down institutional barriers. We want to build teams of researchers, and we want to do research which has both a lasting basic value but can be applied to our environment.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That was Dr. Dennis Fitzpatrick, Associate Vice President for Research at the University of Lethbridge. He's also the chair of WISE, the Water Institute for Semi-Arid Ecosystems. Leading the Scientific Advisory Committee for WISE, the Water Institute for Semi-Arid Ecosystems, is Dr. Derek Peddle. As a professor of geography at the University of Lethbridge, he specializes in GIS technology, and it's a field that gives him the advantage of seeing the big picture when it comes to water issues.
First, GIS stands for Geographical Information Science, and sometimes Geographical Information Systems. But what it is using maps of large areas or maps of small areas, and linking that with, say, satellite technology in terms of an image or an air photo from an airplane. And we use that to get the big picture of looking at perhaps, say, all of Alberta or all of southern Alberta or northern Alberta if we were focused on, say, forest fires. And we can do that on a weekly basis or a monthly basis and repetitively over time throughout a growing season. Year to year to assess change, for example, global change, the effects of climate change. And then we can also bring in, and that technology is mostly remote sensing that I just referred to in terms of images and photographs, but also a big part is geographical information systems. And that brings in all sorts of different maps of, say, in the case of WISE, the Water Institute for Semi-Arid Ecosystems here at U of L, if we had, say, hydrological data over a region, river networks or runoff potential maps, we could link that together with, say, a remote sensing image or, say, a land cover map that was produced by the province of Alberta, for example, and bring all of these different types of data sources together and ask more complex and important questions.
What might be some of those questions that you would be asking in relation to the work with the Water Institute?
Well, here in southern Alberta, of course, what everybody hears about is drought. Drought is a big issue here, and we need to understand the flow of water, the availability of water, and also the quality. So quality and quantity of water is important. And it's important not just at individual points, but also across the region. So we, for example, would take water quality samples at individual locations, say in lakes or rivers. But also then we would put that into a large spatial database and assess that over a larger region and try and develop trends and understand better the impacts and through the locations and patterns of drought.
Now, when we look at your maps, it's really quite easy to see how things change because the northern part of Alberta is essentially green, and then as you come down south, it's nice and pink. So if you were to take your maps of this summer and then, say, compare them to 5 years ago, if that's possible, what is the situation? How have things changed?
When we look at the big picture, we're looking for longer-term trends as well as shorter-term trends. Here in southern Alberta, drought is a long-term issue and certainly has been for several years. I've been in the Lethbridge area for 6 years, and we've had very dry summers and winters, very little precipitation. And but as I said earlier, we were able to quantify that and really put a handle on it much better. Now, this year you asked about, it's rather different. We had more precipitation. We had, in fact, a flood event here, a moderate flood in early June. Some would call it a major flood because they had a lot of damage to their basements and so forth. But the River Valley experienced some flooding here, and one of the themes of the scientific themes of WISE involves aquatic and riparian zones, and that was so this is an interesting year in terms of being a bit of an anomaly, actually. But the broader temporal or time sequence that we see is a consistent pattern of more drought, drier conditions, and widespread, as I mentioned about the satellite images over large areas.
One of the big concerns, too, and you're able to see this with your satellite maps, relates to climate change and the actual physical events that come with that, as well as the economic policies that go along with it. How will you be integrating this with the work that you're doing?
In terms of climate change, if we were to look at, say, southern Alberta or a different part of Alberta and assess it, it would be remiss, really, of us to only focus on one small area and not factor in the broader scale impacts. I mean, drought is a function of is caused by lack of precipitation. Why is that? Well, it's, you know, we have things such as El Nino, broad scale climatic trends over time. This is not something that originates and is limited only to southern Alberta. We need to have an understanding of broader areas at national, international, global scales. And that's why, even though we are particularly focused on the semi-arid here in southern Alberta, we have a very global outreach. So if you look at our website, which I should mention for the people out there, if that's okay, is www.waterinstitute-wise.ca. We have a map on there, and it shows the semi-arid regions of the world. And we've had people contact us from Spain and Europe and parts of Africa and elsewhere in the United States and, well, Europe and Asia, you know, pretty much around the world, interested in the work we're doing, interested to work with us and relate that work to some of the issues that they're dealing with. And we benefit, of course, from them as well. But, yeah, climate change is a big issue. In fact, we have a developing collaboration with some key research institutes in Saskatchewan and Manitoba as well, where we're looking at bringing together the GIS component with some, which really looks at the present for the most part. We can go back about between 30 and 100 years, depending on what type of imagery you're talking about, but also going back thousands of years with paleoclimatic and dendroclimatological records. So basically information in the landscape that we can pull out and assess thousands, decades, centuries of information, and also predicting the future. So we have another person on this particular initiative who's a climate modeler. So they do predictive modeling and what's called numerical simulation. And this is where we take all of the things we understand about the climate system and we put it into a computer program, and we can try and predict the future with certain degrees of confidence. We can also alter things such as, say, the loading of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And that's a big thing, of course, with the Kyoto Protocol, and do some predictions in terms of different scenarios.
Sounds like you really have your work cut out for you here. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome.
That was Dr. Derek Peddle, a professor of geography at the University of Lethbridge and the science director for WISE, the Water Institute for Semi-Arid Ecosystems. One of the scientists involved with the Water Institute for Semi-Arid Ecosystems is Dr. Brent Selinger. He's a professor in biological sciences at the University of Lethbridge, and he's looking at phosphorus runoff from livestock operations and ways to keep this natural fertilizer out of lakes and rivers. It turns out the big culprit is manure from poultry and swine. Unlike cows, chickens and pigs cannot metabolize the phosphorus that's in their feed. And so, out it goes.
Well, the issue is that swine and poultry are monogastric animals, and they have their digestive tracts are a lot simpler than ruminants such as cattle, deer, bison. In monogastric animals, they bring in the nutrients in the acidic stomach. There is some various enzyme activities that break down a lot of the nutrients that are brought into the animals. Unfortunately, they are lacking in enzymes called phytases that are necessary to break down the most prevalent form of phosphorus found in grains. In ruminants, they have the ability to break down the phytic acid or this recalcitrant form of phosphorus in grains, largely because of the microbial community housed in their rumen or a modified fermentation vat that forms a large part of their digestive tract.
So does this mean then that they're eating these grains, they're getting all this phosphorus or phosphate, and then but there's too much of it and it's just being excreted out, and then you've got this excess on the land that causes problems?
Yeah, exactly. What's happening is much of the phosphate found in the grains simply passes straight through their digestive tracts and ends up in the manure, and when the manure is applied to the land, you can have rainfall events which ultimately will move this phosphorus from the land to surface waters, thereby upsetting the delicate balance. Generally speaking, phosphorus is a limiting nutrient found in freshwater ecosystems, and by introducing more phosphorus into these ecosystems, one upsets the balance.
So what can be done to remedy the situation for the swine and the poultry?
Well, one option is to take and spread manure on the land based on with carefully monitored nutrient levels. I think historically we've spread manure on land based on nitrogen levels and relatively ignored the phosphorus content in the manure. And so if one were to spread less manure, that would deal with the issue. However, when we're talking about intensive livestock production, land is a critical factor, and arable land to spread livestock waste on is very important. You need to have the economics of the system require that you only truck your manure a certain distance. If you have to move it beyond that, then the economics get out of control, or at least the producer doesn't make adequate profits to be viable. An alternative is to take and treat the diets with enzymes that will allow the animals to access this form of phosphorus.
Enzymes? What kind of enzyme?
Enzymes like phytases or other types of phosphatases that will allow the animal, that will take and liberate the phosphate groups from the phytic acid and make them available to the animal.
What is it that you're researching then in relation to all of this?
I'm interested in the phytase and its ability to liberate phosphorus from phytic acid. And I'm interested in the ruminant system as well, because there's probably about a half a dozen to a dozen papers published on the subject of phytate degradation in ruminants. Not a lot, but enough to suggest that ruminants are more than capable of digesting phytic acid and getting accessing the phosphate within this compound and using it towards their nutritional needs. Now, I'm a microbiologist, and my interest lies in the ruminants or symbiotic microorganisms that live within the rumen, and really these are the organisms that are responsible for the ruminant's ability to access the phosphorus and phytic acid. So I'm studying the anaerobic bacteria and fungi within the rumen and looking at them at the series of enzymes that they produce, allowing the ruminants to use the phytic acid.
So are you then looking for a way where these could be used more efficiently or effectively by the animals if it's added to their diet?
Oh, of course, yeah. The whole idea is to go in and essentially bioprospect in the rumen. It represents a huge untapped genetic resource. People have been looking at this resource, genetic resource, as a source of enzymes for pulp and paper industry, cellulases, degradation of cellulose and hemicellulose. It's a very rich ecosystem with hundreds of different microbial species that have evolved to break down the materials brought into the rumen by the animal. So I guess could be likened to a genetic prospector. I go in and identify potential organisms that produce the activities, the enzymatic activities I'm interested in, and then I go in and using molecular biology take and dissect apart the organism and look at just how they're capable of using certain nutrients like phytic acid. I take and characterize the genes that encode the enzymes that allow that, for example, the phytase enzymes. Once I've identified these enzymes, then it's a matter of determining just how these enzymes work, and if it's if they're more effective than the current commercial products, then there's always the option to take and commercialize these and produce a new generation, a better, new, improved product. There's also opportunities through the use of recombinant DNA technology to take some of the genes that I've characterized and take and make them better, take and modify them, customize them to a particular process through various techniques that are available through mutagenesis, through DNA shuffling. It's possible to develop new and improved enzymes with characteristics that are suitable for any of a number of industrial processes.
What do you think the importance is of this to the emphasis on improving our water system, especially now that we're dealing with the issue of what could be a continued drought?
Oh, very important. The significance of this sort of research has been demonstrated in several other countries around the world. Countries like Holland and Taiwan with large swine herds have taken and passed legislation to reduce the amount of phosphorus that's going into their waters. In areas such as southern Alberta, where we tend to get a lot less rainfall, and we have to protect water as our resource. We have to take action now, because we know from our experience in other parts of the world that eventually this problem could be our problem as well.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Brent Salinger, an associate professor in biological sciences at the University of Lethbridge. He's a researcher with the Water Institute for Semi-Arid Ecosystems. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during the program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on the website. The web address is innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the University of Lethbridge, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, the Capital Region Innovation Center, Alberta Research Council, the National Institute for Nanotechnology, Alberta Conservation Association, Alberta Ingenuity Fund, Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, True North Energy, and the Health Sciences Association of Alberta. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.